Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. In this age of climate chaos and COVID-19, you count on Democracy Now! To stay focused on the issues that matter most. We count on you to support our independent journalism. If everyone who tunes into Democracy Now! Gave just $4, we could cover our operating costs for 2022. Really, that's all it would take. Please do your part today by visiting us at democracynow.org. Oh, and stay safe, wear a mask, save lives. Thank you so much, and happy holidays. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I will look you in the eye and tell you, as President Biden looked President Putin in the eye and told him today, that things we did not do in 2014, we are prepared to do now.
The United States is threatening new sanctions against Russia if it invades Ukraine. We'll look at the virtual summit between Biden and Putin and why Russia fears NATO's expansion in Eastern Europe. Then to Columbia University, where 3,000 student workers are on strike.
Many students, many parents are writing angry letters to the administration saying, hey, you have the power to fix this immediately. The university said outright that they could easily afford to pay us, but they just don't want to because they don't think it's quote unquote prudent. And that kind of miserliness, which is, you know, completely irrational, is responsible for undergraduates not receiving the education that they paid for.
We'll speak to a student and a professor. Plus, we'll talk to an animal rights activist who's just been convicted on felony charges of burglary and larceny for rescuing a sick baby goat from a goat meat farm during a 2018 direct action live streamed on the web.
One of the reasons we're doing this project today is because we want to show the world, whether it's factory farm or genuinely from a small-scale farm, these animals don't deserve to die. They deserve a chance at life. And we believe killing an animal intentionally is criminal animal cruelty.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Presidents Joe Biden and Vladimir Putin held a two-hour virtual meeting Tuesday amidst mounting tension over the military buildup at the Russia-Ukraine border. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan spoke to reporters following the call.
He told President Putin directly that if Russia further invades Ukraine, the United States and our European allies would respond with strong economic measures. We would provide additional defensive materiel to the Ukrainians above and beyond that which we are already providing.
Russia blamed escalating tensions on Western powers and reiterated opposition to any plans for NATO to expand in Eastern Europe. We'll have more on the story after headlines with the nation's Katrina Vandenhoevel. The House passed a $768 billion military budget Tuesday in a 363-70 vote. The sum is $24 billion higher than what was requested by President Biden, despite withdrawing this year from the U.S.'s longest war in Afghanistan. The package includes funds aimed at countering China's power and to build Ukraine's military strength. It also includes nearly $28 billion in nuclear weapons funding. Separately, the Senate voted down a bipartisan bid by Senators Bernie Sanders, Rand Paul, and Mike Lee to halt $650 million in U.S. arms sales to Saudi Arabia and the devastating ongoing war on Yemen. The House Select Committee investigating the January 6th Capitol insurrection said they would pursue criminal contempt charges against Trump's former chief of staff, Mark Meadows, if he fails to show up for a deposition today. CNN's reporting the House committee has formally subpoenaed phone records for over 100 people, including Meadows. Meanwhile, former Trump advisor Steve Bannon's contempt of Congress trial has been set for July 18th. An early South African study on the Omicron coronavirus variant finds people who receive the Pfizer vaccine could still be vulnerable to breakthrough infection, though a third booster shot appears to offer greater protection. Early data has not shown Omicron causes more severe illness, and health officials have reaffirmed widespread vaccination is the best protection against COVID-19. In other health news, the U.S. Surgeon General Tuesday warned young people are facing a devastating mental health crisis compounded by the ongoing pandemic. Young people have reported higher rates of depression and anxiety, and emergency room visits for suicide attempts went up by over 50% for adolescent girls in early 2021 compared to figures from 2019. French authorities have arrested a Saudi man who's suspected of involvement in the Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi's 2018 murder. Khalid Ad al-Ataibi was detained at a Paris airport as he prepared to fly to Riyadh. But Saudi officials say the man is not the suspect in question and simply has the same name as a former member of the Saudi Royal Guard implicated in the disappearance and killing at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. Last year, a Saudi court jailed eight people for the murder, but rights groups and lawmakers say the plot's masterminds, including Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, have not faced justice. Chile has legalized same-sex marriage after years of organizing and political pressure. The legislation also recognizes adoption and other parental rights of same-sex couples and full spousal benefits. This is Senator Alvaro Elizalde of Chile's Socialist Party.
I believe that this is a historic and relevant day. This victory is a result of years of struggle, fight, and efforts, which aim to not only modify the law, but also change the culture.
The historic vote came as Chileans prepared to cast ballots in a presidential runoff December 19th. The race pits progressive former student activist Gabriel Boric against far-right José Antonio Kast, who has opposed LGBTQ rights during his time as lawmaker. In a landmark ruling last week, Ecuador's constitutional court said plans to mine for copper and gold in a protected cloud forest are unconstitutional and violates the rights of nature. The case involved mining permits that were issued in Los Cedros, a protected area in northwestern Ecuador, which the High Court argued would harm the precious and unique biodiversity of the forest. Los Cedros also stretches into parts of Peru and Colombia. The rights of nature are enshrined in Ecuador's constitution. In Burundi, a massive fire in an overcrowded prison killed at least 38 people, injuring dozens more. The blaze was caused by an electrical short circuit, according to Burundi's interior minister. Rohingya refugees are suing Facebook's parent company, Meta, over its failure to stop violent hate speech on its platform, which contributed to the bloody military crackdown of the Rohingya Muslim community by the Burmese military in 2017. Law firms in the U.S. and U.K. launched the legal effort on behalf of the Rohingya community around the world, including in Bangladeshi refugee camps. Plaintiffs are demanding over $150 billion in damages. The UN found as many as 10,000 Rohingya were killed by Burmese forces during the 2017 genocide, though some estimates put the death toll at more than twice that number. Another 730,000 people were forced to flee Burma. In financial news, the World Inequality Lab found the world's billionaires saw their net worth grow exponentially during the pandemic by more than $3.6 trillion in 2020 alone, while 100 million more people were pushed into extreme poverty. The report also found since 1995, the world's richest 1% claimed 38% of all new wealth, as the poorest half of the global population benefited from just 2%. In Washington, D.C., immigrant justice advocates were joined by progressive lawmakers as they rallied to demand Congress and President Biden include a path to citizenship in the Build Back Better reconciliation bill. This is Wang Chun-Yu with the Hanna Center in Chicago, who immigrated to the U.S. as a child.
In this rare moment, we can use the process to take a step forward for the needs of people. We need our whole humanity. We need our full lives. And that means fighting for citizenship through registry, and that means disregarding the parliamentarian. Immigrants are essential, and we make this country to exist in the first place. We ain't here for parole, and we aren't compromising our lives, and that's the bottom line.
An investigation by House Democrats into the medical abuse and forced sterilization of immigrants detained at Georgia's Irwin County Detention Center found the doctor who performed unnecessary gynecological treatments and surgeries did not meet acceptable standards of care. The investigation also signaled Dr. Mahendra Amin may have performed the invasive procedures to inflate payment from the government and, quote, defraud the Department of Homeland Security and the federal government without consequences. The Senate confirmed Tucson Police Chief Chris Magnus as the next head of Customs and Border Protection. Magnus has faced criticism for his handling of the Tucson police shooting of 27-year-old Carlos Ingram Lopez, who died in April 2020 after police pinned him face down to the ground for 12 minutes at his grandmother's house. Tucson police did not disclose Ingram Lopez's killing until June. The Senate also voted to confirm Jessica Rosenworcel as chair of the Federal Communications Commission, the first woman to serve as permanent chair of the agency. Digital rights activists welcomed the news. She was a fierce critic of the Trump-era repeal of net neutrality protections. Last month, Jonathan Cantor, one of the nation's leading anti-monopoly experts, was confirmed to head the Justice Department's antitrust division. The Senate also unanimously confirmed Charles Chuck Sams III in November as the first ever Native American National Park Service director. Sams is a member of the Cayuse and Walla Walla tribes of the Umatilla Nation. Meanwhile, the White House announced Tuesday that Sauli Amirova has withdrawn her nomination to become controller of the currency after opposition from Republicans and some conservative Democrats. Amirova grew up in Soviet Kazakhstan and came to the U.S. in 1991. During her confirmation hearing, Louisiana Republican John Kennedy accused her of loyalty to the Communist Party of the former Soviet Union. She would have been the first woman, first immigrant, and first person of color to fill the role. Democratic Congress members Jan Schakowsky and Nanette Diaz-Barragan reintroduced the Future Generations Protection Act. The bill, which has 21 other co-sponsors and is backed by a slew of environmental groups, would ban fracking, block new fossil fuel power plants, and ban crude oil and natural gas exports. In business news, the billionaire CEO of digital mortgage company Better.com is under fire after video circulated of him laying off 900 staffers, about 15% of its workforce, on a Zoom call.
If you're on this call, you are part of the unlucky group being laid off. Your employment here is terminated, effective immediately.
CEO Vishal Garg reportedly accused some of the fired employees of working just 2 hours a day. SoftBank, which backs Better.com, had agreed to a $750 million cash injection as it undergoes a merger, and Garg received a $25 million bonus last year. And journalist, music writer, and cultural critic Greg Tate has died. He was 64 years old. He's been described as the godfather of hip-hop journalism. Tate started writing for The Village Voice in 1987, where for years he told stories about Black culture and identity. He went on to write for Rolling Stone, the BBC, and other outlets. In 1992, he published his first book, Flyboy and the Buttermilk, Essays on Contemporary America. He co-founded the Black Rock Coalition, a group that fought against stereotypes of Black artists. Greg Tate's latest piece was published by The Nation in September, an analysis of current Black cultural landscape through the lens of Afro-pessimism by Frank B. Wilderson III. Tate wrote, quote, James Baldwin said, to be a Negro in this country and to be relatively conscious is to be in a state of rage almost all the time. But what he didn't say was that on a good day, it's mostly a sublimated state of rage since folk got bills to pay and sanity to keep. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, the United States is threatening to impose new economic sanctions and other measures if Russia invades Ukraine. President Biden issued the warning Tuesday during a two-hour virtual summit with Russian President Vladimir Putin. The talks were held amidst growing tension between the two countries over the expansion of NATO in Eastern Europe and Russia's deployment of tens of thousands of troops along the border of Ukraine. After the summit, President Biden's National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan spoke to reporters.
President Biden was direct and straightforward with President Putin, as he always is. He reiterated America's support for Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity. He told President Putin directly that if Russia further invades Ukraine, the United States and our European allies would respond with strong economic measures. We would provide additional defensive materiel to the Ukrainians above and beyond that which we are already providing. And we would fortify our NATO allies on the eastern flank with additional capabilities in response to such an escalation. He also told President Putin there's another option, de-escalation and diplomacy.
Russian President Vladimir Putin also spoke after the virtual summit and repeated his opposition to NATO's expansion in Eastern Europe.
By the way, the threat on our western borders really grows. We have talked about it repeatedly. Just look at how close to Russian borders come NATO's military infrastructure. We take it more than seriously. Speaking to the United States and its allies, we would insist on reaching certain agreements that prevent any expanding of the NATO to the east and deploying weapon systems threatening to us close to Russia.
To talk more about the Biden-Putin virtual summit and other issues, we're joined by Katrina VandenHeuvel, editorial director and publisher of The Nation magazine, also columnist for The Washington Post. She's been reporting for and from, for the last 30 years and on Russia. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Katrina.
Thank you, Amy. Thank you, Juan.
Can you start off by responding to what happened yesterday and talk about the escalation of tension on the Russia-Ukraine border?
Absolutely. This escalation is not new, Amy. I mean, it goes back, in fact, we have a one-sided narrative in this country, which is a problem because we haven't followed the growing mass of NATO troops on Ukraine's Russia's border. The escalation is neither in the United States national interest nor security interests at a time when politics, political solution, diplomatic solution is the only way forward. And got to go back. History matters, Amy. You mentioned NATO expansion. In 1990, Gorbachev presided over the reunification of Germany, and James Baker promised not one inch eastward. NATO would not expand one inch eastward. Well, that promise, which is documented in the National Security Archives, in Condi Rice's book, in other materials, was violated. And I think that's the original sin of what we witness today. It's hard for Americans to understand NATO expansion and what it means to Russia, having a mass of NATO troops on a border. Warsaw Pact, which was the military alliance counter to NATO, collapsed. NATO is not a coffee clutch. It's a military organization. In addition, the United States has spent about $2.5 billion in drones and whatever non-lethal means, weapons. So in addition to looking at Russia's troops in Donbass, in forces there, we have to look at the other side of the story, which I'll end. It's also naval and air provocations in the last months. Nuclear bomber flying 12 miles from Russia's border. This is not reported in the United States media. It is in the military press. But I think you need to have the full vantage point to understand what we're witnessing now. And the only way forward, the one wise thing Jake Sullivan said, is we need de-escalation and a diplomatic political solution. There is no military solution. And President Biden is not sending American men and women to fight in Ukraine. That is a crazy elevation of a problem that can be solved politically, diplomatically.
And Katrina, I wanted to ask you precisely about this issue of the failure to report the U.S. buildup in the region. You were mentioning the military press. It reported that on October 30th, the USS Porter entered the Black Sea. About a week later, the USS Whitney and the Sixth Fleet indicated that more ships were going into the Black Sea. This is tantamount to a Chinese or Russian military ship buildup on the Gulf of Mexico. Could you talk as well about the increased arms sales that have occurred from the United States, and even the fact that U.S. advisors are training Ukrainian troops in the Western Ukraine right now. So the buildup is not just on the Russian side, is it?
No, this again goes back, one, to the one-sided narrative that permits sort of the Cold War media establishment to portray it as a one-sided situation. We need to understand that this has a history, and Ukraine has a long significance to Russia. The underreporting of U.S. involvement is a disservice to American people, because they're getting every day. I picked up the papers this morning. It's Russian aggression, Russian aggression. There is Russian aggression, but there's also U.S. complicity with drones, with, as you said, whatever non-lethal weapons are. Now, Obama, to his credit, held up shipments. Trump went back and forth. Biden has moved forward. I mean, you do have a danger here of a president who is doing some good things at home, but seems committed to the old Cold War tropes and is driving Russia and China together, is not making America more secure, nor is he using his resources to not partner with, but work with Russia on mutual interests, such as climate, nuclear proliferation. I mean, Clinton's Secretary of Defense says we're closer to nuclear war than we've ever been since the Cuban Missile Crisis. These are important issues that are getting obscured in the United States in some ways, and Russia complicit. This is a civil war, but it has become a proxy war between the United States, Russia, NATO. And so I think we need to step back before there could be an accidental escalation. But, you know, so that's where I think we are done a disservice. As you at Democracy Now! Know very well, and we at The Nation know, if you don't get the full side, full debate, full range of views, you're not learning what's going on, and that's our role to really dig deep.
And could you talk about the role of European Union in this? Clearly, the Biden administration has been signaling that if Russia does send its troops into Ukraine, that there will be many more, considerably more sanctions this time around, and specifically on this Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline that Russia is building. But the reality is that already Europe depends on Russia for close to 40% of all of its natural gas needs. And so what is there a separation of interests to some degree between the European Union and the United States on how to deal with Russia?
Absolutely, Juan. I think, first of all, I think our foreign policy has become one of sanctions reach, and I'm not just talking about Russia, but the expansion of sanctions could well drive a wedge, a growing wedge between the European Union, the United States, Russia, and drive Russia again more closely tied to China. But, you know, you have a new government in Germany. I believe Nord Stream 2 has been approved, yet German regulators still need to sign off. There's no question that it's a way of Russia moving around other gas streams. But there are other sanctions in play, too. I mean, the most drastic one, which, I mean, is just being recklessly talked about, is removing Russia from the SWIFT global banking system. I don't know enough about it, except that it will again drive Russia more closely toward China and alternative forms of currency. But I do think the sanctions overreach is something that is, we should be trying to work together, not as friends necessarily, but as working partners. It is such a waste of resources. You talk about Russian troops, you know, amassing. They're already there. We know that. There is a diplomatic resolution, Juan and Amy, which Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute wrote about in the Nation cover story a week or so ago, which is this Minsk Accord, which the UN and the United States endorsed in 2015. And it would bring together, you were talking about the European allies, Juan, it would bring together Germany, France, Russia, Ukraine, a role for the United Nations. And it would essentially demilitarize the eastern part of Ukraine, Donbass. It would return federal language rights, which has been a big issue. It would possibly put Crimea into a UN-moderated referendum situation, but not clear at all. But Minsk is a way forward that would reduce tensions, that would lead toward a better situation in Ukraine. I mean, what's not reported again, or very rarely, or column 26, is 13,000 lives have been lost in this proxy war. And I think we owe it to families, others in Ukraine, to try and find a way to halt this military conflict.
And yet it's not only Biden. It looks like the House, Democratic House of Representatives, is going in the same direction. The House passing the $768 billion military budget, $24 billion higher than what was requested from Biden. And some of that money is going to be going to countering China's power, building up the nuclear weapons arsenal, and sending weapons to Ukraine.
This is such a tragedy. At a moment, we've emerged slowly, barely, from COVID, from a pandemic. The idea of more money for nuclear weapons, which is in this bill. How do nuclear weapons relate to dealing with pandemics? We need to invest in the existential crises, producing these crises, climate, nukes, pandemics. So I think Congress, there is a Reduce the Defense Budget Caucus, Mark Pocan, Barbara Lee. They're very good voices. But what we need in this country, on the eve, by the way, of the summit, Democracy Summit Biden has called, which again is a kind of Cold War feel to it, is we need to understand that our democracy is on a ventilator, and we need to rebuild our home, to get our act in order at home, before we go out preaching to other countries. And I think we've seen a revival of this national security strategy where we've made Russia and China the grave enemies. They're not going to be friends, but mutual interests demand a working partnership. And I feel that for reasons we could spend another show on, is slipping away unless we wake up and understand that it's simply sober realism, that we're not going to send men and women to Ukraine, that we need to sort out a relationship with Russia, that China is the great challenge in the next century, if not beyond. And those demand a full, robust debate, which you do have on Democracy Now!, but the one-sided coverage, and it's not even commentary, in the U.S. media about U.S.-Russia is, I think, debilitating and dangerous for our security and thinking.
Katrina VandenHeuvel, you talk about the democracy slipping away. It's something also that the Russian journalist Dmitry Muratov is talking about, who will receive the Nobel Peace Prize on Friday, along with the Filipina journalist Maria Ressa. You have known Dmitry for many years. He is warning people about a descent into fascism around the world. Can you talk about his role in the independent media movement?
He founded his newspaper Novaya Gazeta in a cafeteria 30 years ago. It has remained the independent voice. It has survived. It has done some of the most extraordinary investigations into prison conditions, into corruption. It is a paper of humanism. That he survives, six of his journalists, including Anna Politkovskaya, have been killed, is a testament to his strength, his resilience, and his ability to navigate a system that is not as closed as some Americans think, but demands a commitment to democracy. Mikhail Gorbachev, the other recipient of a Nobel Peace Prize in the last century, is a part supporter of the newspaper. It has trained a new generation of investigative reporters, mostly women, and I think it will survive because it has this great, great spirit. And that he won the Nobel Peace Prize, and Maria Ressa, who I know a little, is a testament to the journalism needed in these times that is so connected to this future possibilities of a democracy that is under siege everywhere, including in our country.
Katrina VandenHeuvel, I want to thank you for being with us, editorial director and publisher of The Nation magazine, columnist for The Washington Post, has reported on Russia for the last 30 years. Next up, the largest strike in the United States is underway here in New York City at Columbia University. They've called on unions to help them shut down the school today. We'll speak with a striking student worker and a professor who supports them. Stay with us.
Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. For the union makes us strong. It is we who grade the papers and prepare the syllabus. Hold office hours daily, give advice that you can trust. Imagine taking finals without help from all of us. For the union makes us strong.
Solidarity Forever, sung on the picket line of the student workers at Columbia University who are on strike for a fair contract. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The largest strike in the United States is happening right now here in New York City at Columbia University. 3,000 student workers, graduate and undergraduate, are facing down the private university. They're in their fifth week of the strike, and the stakes are rising. Columbia has threatened to replace all 3,000 of the striking student workers if they don't return to work by Friday. This is Paul Brown, an organizer with the Student Workers of Columbia, United Auto Workers, Local 2110, speaking Monday at a protest on campus.
If an administrator takes a sick day, you know, nothing really happens. But if a grad student takes a sick day, or like a facilities person takes a sick day, or a postdoc takes a sick day, like classes would have to be canceled and stuff like that. And so I guess just really kind of reorienting the perception and the culture of graduate school from like, oh, we're just students, we should be glad to be here, to, you know, respecting the labor that we put into this institution.
On Monday, many Columbia faculty members walked out of their classes in a show of solidarity with the striking student workers and joined their picket line on the campus's iconic College Walk. This is English professor Jack Halberstam addressing the protest.
I think it's important that the university understand that this isn't just about the demands that you're making, which, by the way, are utterly reasonable demands. Cost of living raise. What is the problem, right? Dental care, as someone who went into debt for root canals as a graduate student, yes, please, dental care. These are absolutely basic. And then the difficult issue of third-party arbitration, right? And I think I understand more about that after the meeting yesterday. So what I think is helpful is just to remind ourselves that there is a larger context within which this strike takes place. Student workers, I say this. We are with you. We stand with you. We see you. We fight alongside you. To faculty allies, I say, this is our fight. This is our university. This is our chance to say no to the corporate university here and now. This is not Goldman Sachs.
Professor Jack Halberstam will be joining us in a minute. Today, the student workers are calling on others to help them shut down the university from 8 to 6 by not crossing their picket line. They're asking professors and students not to enter campus, not to go to classes, not to hold classes. One of their slogans is, New York is still a union town, and members of other unions from around the city are expected to join in solidarity. For more, we're joined by the professor you just heard, Jack Halberstam, professor of English and Gender Studies at Columbia University, and by Johanna King Slutsky, a PhD student in English and Comparative Literature at Columbia University, rank and file member of Student Workers of Columbia. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Johanna, let's begin with you. This is now the largest strike in the United States that's going on right now. Can you tell us why you're striking? It's not actually the first strike by the Columbia students this year.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you for having me on this program. So this is our second strike this year. We struck last spring as well. And we have really basic demands. Our priority contract articles are, as Jack mentioned in the speech that you all just heard, a raise so that we meet cost of living standards. We have a lower, you know, income compared to cost of living than any peer institution. We're also asking for healthcare that includes vision and dental benefits. We're asking for protections against sexual harassment and discrimination. And we're asking for full unit recognition for any member who the National Labor Relations Board said should be able to join. The university has been trying to keep out some of our legal members. And we're really motivated, as Professor Halberstam said in the speech you guys heard, we really see ourselves as part of a broader labor movement, both in higher education, which has been, facing terrible trends of adjunctification and administrative overreach, and in the union, in the labor movement overall.
And Johanna, could you talk about what precisely the student workers do at Columbia and what the university's response has been to your demands?
Yeah, student workers, we are the majority of workers, or at least instructional workers and research workers at the university. We are the ones who do the research that wins grant money for the university. We are teachers. We are teaching assistants, research assistants. I teach my own class. Many of my colleagues teach the same classes that a professor would teach. And we are the ones who have the most face time with the undergraduates who are paying Columbia's bills, paying tuition.
And increasingly, has Columbia, as many universities around the country, have increasingly gone to student workers and contingent lecturers instead of tenure track faculty to teach most of their courses?
Yeah, it's a huge problem in the higher ed movement. But there's been a real shift towards hiring contingent faculty, meaning people that the university can replace very quickly and easily. They have very few rights. They make much less income, and graduate workers as well are facing kind of a similar onslaught. In many ways, it feels like we're lambs being raised for the slaughter. I think and many of my colleagues feel like there's a really good chance that we're going to become one of these adjuncts or contingent faculty members after we graduate. And that's one of the reasons we're motivated in this fight. I think that we really see this as telling administrators, telling universities that have billions and billions of dollars in reserve that could easily afford to pay graduate workers, undergrads who TA, who pay, adjuncts, they can afford to pay us a living wage. They've said outright that they can afford to pay us a living wage and that they, just don't think it's prudent, that they don't want to. And if you can afford to pay us a living wage, I don't really understand why one of my colleagues, whether they're a grad worker or an adjunct or a full professor, should have to do things like not take his son to the dentist because we don't get dental coverage or because we don't make enough money to pay for dental coverage out of pocket.
Johanna, I want to read an email sent by David Driscoll, the vice president of Columbia University Human Resources, to the over 3,000 students at Columbia last week. It's been made public. It reads in part, "In order to plan coverage for the spring term in a timely fashion, the following categories of student officers will receive their letter in the normal course. A, student officers who are currently working as shown by their attestations. B, students who are not currently on appointment. Or C, student officers who are currently on strike but return to work by December 10th, as shown by their attestation for the current pay period. Please note that striking student officers who return to work after December 10th will be appointed, assigned to suitable positions if available." Johanna, can you respond to what the university is doing and talk about the significance of today, this day, and the action growing ever larger?
Yeah, that email, the language sounds bland, but it was very alarming. For those who can't speak administrator, what they're saying is that they are planning to replace those of us who remain on strike through the end of the week. This is an illegal form of retaliation. We are on an unfair labor practice strike, which protects us from our labor being permanently replaced. And yet they're threatening to do that very thing. It's frightening because it's illegal, but the university has a much greater megaphone, much more power than we do. And it's easy for them to get away with illegal activity like that. We are shutting down campus today to kind of tell the university that we and other unions in the city and faculty, we're not okay with them just bulldozing over us. It's completely not only illegal, but unjust to fire, in effect, people like me. I stand to lose my job, my appointment, my teaching appointment. I have my own class that I'm supposed to teach next semester, and I might not have a class to return to because I've been exercising my legally protected right to withhold my labor. And so we are having a massive picket. For those who are in New York City, you're welcome to come down to our campus and join us in the picket. It's going to be a very joyful experience. And we are asking every student and every faculty member not to cross the picket by attending class or holding class. And, you know, as Paul in the speech that you guys shared said, when the teachers, which is, you know, graduate students like me, when we shut down, when we stop working, the university grinds to a halt, and we really want to make that clear.
Well, I'd like to bring in Professor Jack Halberstam into the conversation, professor of English and gender studies at Columbia University. Could you talk somewhat about the faculty response to the strike? And also, my understanding is that Columbia's endowment right now is a little bit over $14 billion. It increased about $3 billion in the past year of the pandemic. Could you talk about the ability of the university to meet the demands of the strikers?
Yeah, thank you, Juan. And Johanna has been very eloquent already about the fact that the university can meet the demands of the students, but chooses not to, despite the fact that the university said that it was going into a kind of financial freefall during COVID. It turns out that, along with many other corporate stakeholders, universities did very well during COVID on the stock market. And some people suggest that the endowment grew by $3.1 billion. So we were all asked to share in austerity measures during COVID, but as often happens with corporate entities, people are not asked to share in the profits once a financial crisis is over. And what the students are saying is that, you know, New York is an incredibly expensive place to live, and you are supposed to be offered a graduate education that does not put you in debt. Student debt right now is a tremendous burden on this generation of intellectuals. And they are also looking at a future in which, as Johanna said, their labor has been meted out to adjuncts who have no protection, not very few benefits, and no opportunity to save for retirement. So what we're doing is we're bankrupting a whole generation in order to provide more profits for the university. And this is, apart from anything else, it's unethical. The faculty response in the humanities and social sciences has been strong and supportive, but there is not the same response across the university. And I think many of us recognize that the university does not value the work that goes on in the humanities, in particular, in the same way that it values the work in the professional schools, which then return money to the system in many, many different forms. So what we, the faculty, are concerned about is a larger project of downsizing the humanities, the place where people get trained to think critically about the world that they live in and think radically about how to transform it. And the grad students are absolutely aware of this and are fighting this battle on many fronts. And they expected 37 faculty at the rally the other day. There were over 100 people there, over 100 faculty, many of them very prominent faculty with real political commitments to the strike.
Can you tell us about the letter that was sent to the Columbia College Dean James Valentini, where faculty expressed their view that the lack of graduate student labor has harmed undergraduate education and that these harms will be exacerbated if this strike isn't resolved? Some of them are talking about not being able to grade the students and parents now weighing in. Can you talk about what it means to teach and be a student at Columbia right now?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, graduate student labor is the invisible labor of the university. Graduate students do everything behind the scenes of a class. I'm teaching a class right now with 90 students and three TAs. And without those TAs, I field upwards of 40 emails a day from students. Papers are not graded. Discussion sections are not held. Office hours are not held. Undergraduate education suffers immensely. And what Johanna said is really important, which is that, you know, a lot of the teaching at Columbia is done by graduate students. So people who are paying $50,000, $60,000 a year often are being taught by a student instructor who receives $30,000 a year. They are not being taught by the Nobel Prize winning professor upon whose reputation Columbia rests. They are often being taught by graduate students who are underpaid and undervalued. The faculty have become very frustrated by the way that the administration is not giving us reasons for why they won't settle with the student workers. And that, you know, is spurring these letters. That's what's motivating these letters. People are saying, hey, maybe I would even support the university. But what is the university's position? Nobody really knows. No message has gone out other than we don't want to respond to this. And it's very, very frustrating as a professor. Very frustrating.
And Professor Halberstam, you've been a tenured professor there for years now at Columbia. How does this strike compare to other protests that have come and gone at the university while you've been there?
I've only been at Columbia for 5 years, but there is a long history, as Professor May Nye said at the rally the other day, a long history of student protest at Columbia going back to 1968 when students protested segregation policies and protested the university's support of the Vietnam War. And those were very, very powerful protests involving hunger strikes and leading to the creation of some of the programs in race and ethnicity at Columbia.
Juan, I'm afraid we're going to have to end with the person you're speaking to who just asked you that question, Professor Halberstam, and that is our very own Juan Gonzalez, who was one of the leaders of that student strike that you're referring to in 1968, Juan.
Yes, and I remember May Nye from those days as well. She was quite an activist in her time before she became a much decorated professor and historian. But I think that it's critical. I think back then, even some of the major professors of those days, people like Eric Bentley and Robert Brustein, were big supporters of the students, and they helped quite a bit in keeping our morale going to be able to emerge victorious in that strike.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us, Jack Halberstam, professor of English and Gender Studies at Columbia University, and Johanna King-Slutsky, rank-and-file member of Student Workers of Columbia, a PhD student in the English and Comparative Literature Department at Columbia. Coming up, we speak to an animal rights activist who's just been convicted on felony charges of burglary and larceny for rescuing a sick baby goat from a goat meat farm. Stay with us. Mazafreak by Burnt Sugar, which was led by Gray Tate, who died Tuesday at the age of 64. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. In North Carolina, an animal rights activist has been convicted on felony charges of burglary and larceny for removing a sick baby goat from a goat meat farm. Wayne Chung was given a suspended sentence and 24 months probation. The co-founder of the animal rights organization Direct Action Everywhere was arrested in 2018 for taking the baby goat from the Suspiro Goat Ranch in North Carolina in a direct action that the group live-streamed in an effort to expose animal cruelty. In a moment, Wayne will join us. But first, I want to go back to what happened on that night in 2018. Wayne Chung spoke on a live stream as he drove toward the farm.
The plan is we're going to park the car outside of the farm, make a little U-turn, get the car ready to leave. We are going to go in, document the conditions. We're going to have dog treats. We've actually tried this before in the past. We have a huge number of dog treats in our pants because we know these barking dogs are going to need something to calm them down if we're going to stop them from alerting the farm. The farm security is just a few hundred feet from where the goats are, so that's another reason this is extremely dangerous. If we need to make a getaway, we're actually going to have to make a run down a hill. Just changed my four-wheel drive to four-wheel low. We're going to have to make a run down a hill, jump onto a tree stump, and then jump across an electrified fence in order to get out. And if we have to do that with a goat, we'll do it. But we're going to do whatever we can to make sure at least one of these animals gets out. And for those of you who don't know what open rescue is, the idea behind open rescue is we believe what we're doing is right, that there is nothing wrong with trying to take an animal from harm's way. And many of you know, I've been accused of being a terrorist, a criminal. I'm being sued by a major turkey farm, all for taking animals who are quivering in fear and pain to the vet. And that's all we're going to do today. We're going to take an animal who's scared, who does not want to die. We're going to take her to the vet, and the industry wants to claim that this is a crime. And we know that's not true, and I know that many of you know that's not true either.
Minutes later, Wayne Chung of Direct Action Everywhere entered the goat farm for the rescue operation.
There's a baby right there, guys. Okay, so there's a baby right here. She looks like she's pretty young. All these goats are going to be sent to slaughter. There are 1 million goats killed every year in the United States. It's one of the fastest growing types of meat in the United States, unfortunately, because people think it's sustainable. But the reality is these poor mothers had their babies taken away from them over and over again. They're raising these tiny pens. Look at this little pen for this mom and her baby. It's going to be heartbreaking to take this baby away from her mama. And we're going to say, I'm sorry to the mama and tell her we're going to give the baby a good life. But if we leave the baby here, she's going to be killed. And the way they kill these poor goats is just heartless. They drag them by their hind legs. They hit them on the head with a captive bolt gun. Many of them are not even unconscious when they're ultimately eviscerated in the slaughter line. So this is the future for this baby. We can't allow that to happen. So we're going to take her out.
The group Direct Action Everywhere continued to live stream after Wayne Chung had taken the goat from the farm.
So we got a little baby here, and she is sad because, you know, her mama had taken her, but we didn't alarm, we didn't trigger any sort of attention, which is good, but this baby's scared. She's never been outside of that little pen. And let me turn around the other way a little bit so you guys can all see her. But she's very young. I mean, she's not just born, but her fur is still kind of just developing. She's only about, I'd say, 7 pounds. So at adult weight, goats will be 35 pounds or so. And the two breeds of goat they become most commonly used in goat meat are Kiko breeds and Boer goats. She looks like probably a Kiko, which is from New Zealand, because she's got a black head. Boer goats tend to have brown heads. And they'll usually raise them for about 6 months, and they'll send them off to a processing plant for slaughter.
That was Wayne Chung, co-founder of the animal rights group Direct Action Everywhere in 2018. He was convicted this week for that action and given a suspended sentence of 2 years probation. He's a former faculty member at Northwestern Law School, and as a lawyer, he represented himself during the trial. He joins us now from Asheville, North Carolina. Wayne Chung, last Monday, you began your opening statements by saying the question of this case is really a simple one. The question is compassion a crime? Talk about why you did this, what you call a rescue, and respond to your sentence. You were convicted, but then given a suspended sentence.
Told to be out of jail right now. I very much expected to be in a North Carolina jail facility. And I think the reason I'm out of jail is because of media attention from places like The Intercept and Democracy Now! But The reason we're doing this is because there is incredible amount of animal cruelty unfolding in states like North Carolina, which has a very powerful agricultural industry. And when citizens have complained about this, including employees at some of these farms, the government has consistently, instead of trying to create some transparency or accountability in corporate animal agriculture, passed laws to prevent undercover investigations, passed laws preventing local citizens from suing pig farms and other facilities for polluting the local air and the water. And so activists have started resorting to direct action tactics to expose what's happening and to try to give some direct care to the animals who are suffering.
And during your trial, the judge repeatedly sustained objections from the prosecution when you tried to explain your past animal rescue efforts, including a goat named Lenny.
Yeah, that's right. It was a strange trial, you know, because there are so many folks on the right who are advocating for free speech, which I think is a worthy cause to advocate for. But in this case, even when I was trying to present a defense for in my own criminal case, we were prevented from talking about our reasons for being there. The state filed a motion on the first day of trial saying you're not allowed to talk about the conditions the animals were facing, the veterinary care you provided them. And so my opening statement was cut off mid-sentence, and I was not allowed to talk to the jury about why we were there. And one of the strangest things about the state's motion was the way they phrased it was, witnesses at this testimony, at this trial, are not allowed to talk about efforts they made to protect the life of the property at issue. And that's just such a strange non sequitur, the idea that we're talking about the life of property. And I think it goes to the central issue. Are the living creatures of this earth property? Are they living creatures that deserve some form of dignity and respect?
Wayne, what's happened to the goat since then, if you could talk about that? And then do you see your case as setting any kind of precedent? And can you talk about animal farmers?
Yeah. So the goat was immediately rushed to a veterinarian when he removed him, and he had pneumonia. And unfortunately, we're not allowed to talk about this at trial. And the veterinarian recalled was stopped mid-sentence from describing the treatment the goat received. But he's happy and healthy. And unfortunately, because the authorities attempted to return the goat to the farm, I don't actually know where he is. Activist Kadeb Skand and take him away somewhere where I don't know, but I've heard he's in good shape. But I think this is going to set a precedent because the prosecution thought this was going to be a very easy and quick trial. They thought it was going to be a one-day trial, would convict and hopefully incarcerate me for a long time. But there were dozens of local residents who came out and protested. There were, my understanding is, thousands of people wrote to the local district attorney and complained and said, why are you protecting property more than protecting life? And partly as a result, I think they decided we don't want to turn this guy into a martyr. So they didn't put me in prison. They said, let's just let him go and tell him to get out of North Carolina. So that's what I'm planning to do.
And the animal farmers?
Yeah. So one of the things that came out in court is that, you know, a lot of the animal farming industry has been describing us as terrorists. And you could see in the live stream what we did. All we did was take a sick animal to a veterinarian. And the fact that we live in a political system where trying to help a suffering living creature is terrorism, while exploiting that same animal is just business as usual, is an indication of how the political priorities of this system and the industry of animal farming are just out of whack. I mean, it doesn't make a lot of sense. So, you know, I think that if we had gotten a chance to talk in a trial openly about these issues and present the evidence of what actually happens in animal farms, the jury might have been swayed. But at the same time, we got a wonderful chance, not in the court of law, but in the court of public opinion to talk about these issues openly. And that way, I think we are setting a very important precedent.
And at the end of the trial, the prosecutor gave you a hug. Do you think you changed some minds during the process of the trial?
Yeah, it was a strange thing because the prosecution, the judge, were all very hardened and thought this guy's a radical. He's an extremist. Let's throw him in jail and throw away the key. And the jury didn't get to hear most of the evidence of animal cruelty. The judge and the prosecution did. And I think my sense was both the judge and the prosecution, when we were arguing about what evidence should be allowed, we had to talk about that evidence. And even they, and when they heard about how much a baby goat suffers when they have pneumonia, when they heard about the fact that one of the baby goats was covered of lice and unable to stand, and they were swayed. Because I think the reality is when any of us are confronted with the reality of what happens in some of these industrial slaughterhouses and farms, or even small-scale facilities, even the thought of cutting one animal's throat, killing one animal, is disturbing. And they were swayed. And that's a victory for us, I think.
Wayne Shung, I want to thank you for being with us, animal rights advocate, co-founder of Direct Action Everywhere, just convicted on felony charges, burglary and larceny for removing a sick baby goat from a goat meat farm. Got a suspended sentence of 2 years. Thanks to everyone who tuned in for our 25th anniversary celebration Tuesday night. You can watch the full event at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.